You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, how did Dr. J become an ABA legend? Hello, welcome to Over and Back. This is Jason. You're about to listen to the second part of my conversation with Rainus Lattice of the Handle Podcast and the Marmatic YouTube account. You definitely listened to our first part where we discussed Julius Erving's early days in the ABA and Rucker Park and how he was nicknamed the Doctor. I also have a third Dr. J episode coming with Curtis Harris of Pro Hoops History, where we get into his Philly years of the late 70s and early 80s. So now, we are joined in progress as Julius Erving has been traded from the Virginia Squires to the New York Nets and is taking a major step toward becoming a basketball legend. The 74 season, they are... there's only four seasons in NBA, ABA history where a player has 25 plus points per game, 10 plus rebounds per game, 5 plus assists per game, and 2 plus steals per game. Erving has three of them, including this one, and the other was George McGinnis in 75. So obviously that very special accomplishment from him. It kind of shows what just kind of the tremendous all around player that he really was during that time. I mean, the guy that I think of when I compare, and they were certainly different style and different body types, but they did have some of the same types of skills as LeBron James, as far as just being a complete guy who was, both a superstar scorer and had the ability to, fill up the stat sheet and do everything and be a great rebounder and be a great defender.
Yeah, and as there is with LeBron, it was the same for Julius, that you always tend to question his shooting a bit. It's both have proven themselves in big moments, and actually I think are better shooters than we give them credit for. But you always have the sense that there might be a big game where either Erving did back then or when LeBron could right now, they could struggle with shots from outside. So yeah, very similar in their overall skill set and weaknesses.
So the 74 Nets have a 4.80 SRS, 55-29. Erving connects to the new Nets coach, Kevin Lockery, his frankness and his ability to adjust. Lockery had just come from he actually played early on in the NBA for the infamous 73 Sixers, who only won 9 games. He ended up as their coach for the latter third of the season. He did not have a good record, but it was still better than Roy Rubin's record beforehand. So, and you would not necessarily think that having won, having a coach with a terrible record was a good idea, but ended up being great. They really got along in Lockery. Doc really thought that he was very good at adjusting to, he had a game plan, but was very able to adjust to what was going on in the game, had a great feel for the game. He didn't really like coaches who sort of stuck with one game plan and weren't willing to make adjustments based on, whether something was and wasn't working, and felt that Lockery was excellent at, seeing things right away and adjusting to them. Rod Thorne was Lockery's assistant, and it felt like the team had a very good chemistry and a very good loose feeling.
Yeah, and I suppose it speaks to Julius himself, who, as you said, towards the beginning of the show, who wanted to incorporate the things he could do on the playground in real basketball, but also play within a team structure. So someone like Lockery might have been the perfect coach for him.
And some of the other key players on the team, Billy Paltz, who was a 3-time All-Star center known as the Whopper, and
I love that nickname.
Yes, and Bill Melchione, who was a very good veteran point guard, a 3-time All-Star. It had helped both of these guys had helped the Nets to the 72 Finals. So yeah, as we mentioned, it had just been a good team just before they were down after losing Bear in the 73 season. And Brian Taylor, who Erving said might be the fastest guard he ever played with, was also had very quick hands, an excellent passer, described as a poor man's Walt Frazier, I believe, in loose balls. So, and then two rookies who were important to the team, Super John Williamson, who was a big physical guard, and was known for stiff-arming anyone who tried to guard him, also known as being free-spirited and fun, was a cooking and kung fu enthusiast, and Larry Keenan, who was another talented guard, but also was very country, and Irving shares sort of an amazing story of having a tough time trying to find him a nickname, where at first they were calling him Dr. K, and he didn't like that because he felt like he was in Julius's shadow, and he wanted Mr. K, but nobody really liked that, or Special K. Eventually they settled on Cat, so K-A-T, sort of similar to, of course, Carl Anthony Towns' nickname now. John Williamson referred to himself as a Super John, and they would sort of give him give him a little bit of hassle for that. Say, like, who exactly is calling you Super John? He's like, everybody's calling me Super John. And guys would be like, I never heard that. And they kind of gave an example. Those are examples of sort of the, loose, free chemistry that the guys had. And they were, played cards together. Even Lockery would, having just been a player, would play cards with the team. And they had a, great camaraderie. And, of course, played very well together, were good. They complement each other very well, and we're all pretty good at filling their roles around Irving, understanding that of course Irving was the most important player on the team, and everyone kind of fell in line for the most part.
What I find impressive was how young this team was, and it probably helped create that friendly environment, because if you take away Melchione, who played in six games during the playoffs, they didn't have a rotation player older than 25. As you mentioned, Keenan and Williamson both were rookies and were 21 and 22 respectively. Julius was only 23. Billy Paltz was the eldest of these guys. He was 25. Taylor and Gale are 22 and 23. They didn't really have a notable player who was a solid veteran. I suppose that Paltz had some seasons under his belt, but other than that, it basically, it was like OKC if they had won in 2012. And as for Keenan's nicknames, we really have an abundance of Special Ks in that period of time, because off the top of my head, Greg Kelser and Clark Kellogg were also Special Ks. I think I'm missing someone else. But yeah, no definite Special Ks, and too many Special Ks who apparently didn't want to be called Special Ks.
Yeah, I think Cat is a better nickname, so I think he was smart to go with that one.
Yeah, and he was, I think you could describe him as being Cat Quit. Keenan was someone who could really leap for some exciting dunks.
Yeah, absolutely. So they did struggle a bit early on. They lost nine straight. They had a team meeting, and they basically decide that they're very much both a fast break team and a pressing team, and they decide that they're wearing out from all the running. That Irving, he can do that in certain circumstances, but he can't do that all the time, every game, and wearing them out. So they change their style some. They switch their starting lineup. I know Super John's brought in, and Melchione, who was the veteran of the team and had been an all ABA player, was subbed out, and it works. They win 19 of 22. The one worry that Irving had about the team was that they had a lack of toughness. So John Roach ends up being traded to Kentucky for Mike Gale and Wendell Ladner. Gale, a good defensive guard. And Ladner, of course, one of the great all-time characters in ABA history. Famous for fights and famous for diving for loose balls. And also for chasing women. he and Doc develop a close friendship, and they live near each other. And even though they're very much opposites, Ladner is from Mississippi, very much country boy. He and Doc, they hang out a lot and end up having a good friendship. And Ladner brings some defensive intensity and toughness and just kind of physical frightening and physical intimidation to the team, and that helps them thrive even more. They finish 11-1 to finish the season, and are doing very well heading into the playoffs.
Yeah, and I just love how every ABA tough guy was seemingly this 6'3", 6'4", guy who weighed about 210 or 220, and like Wendell Ladner or John Brisker or the other guys, and they would just seemingly didn't care, and they would tough it up with everyone, and they would randomly charge against guys.
Yeah, Ladner was a guy known for starting fights before games. Would have, you know, just you know, getting into you know, fights in, you know, during pregame, or just you know, he was a bit crazy, and was. He was also traded three times in one season, which he definitely bounced around a bit in the ABA. I think known for two things, primarily, first of all, for, you know, being part of these Nets teams, this Nets team in particular, and then also, of course, the famous posing, the Burt Reynolds pose in the Kentucky Colonels poster that he is known for as well, so...
And possibly he might be the worst shooter ever, who was actually a player who supposedly contributed to the team, because when you look at his stats, and some in a way it is affected by his love for the three pointer, but he was a terrible shooter whose percentage would fluctuate around 32-44%, and it's in a way it's amazing that he actually could contribute to a championship team with the way he would take wild shots.
Yes, sort of the Josh Smith of his time, perhaps in that respect. But so the Nets end up beating the Squires 4-1 in the division series. The Squires, of course, have George Carter, Jim Eakins, and Cincy Powell also added to the team. This one got about a bit heated. Fatty Taylor was ejected at the in one of the games for hitting a Super John with two forearm shots to the back of the head. Taylor said that Super John had elbowed him first, and also Bianchi was ejected from that game. It was a fairly easy win for the Nets. Irving missed a game winner in Game 3. That was the only game that the Squires won. It was the last playoff series, in fact, for the Squires, as they would, you know, they weren't a very good team, particularly good team. They were, they didn't have a good record this season, and those records would only get worse. They're 28-56, so the fact that they made the playoffs in the season, even though they had that record, indicates the growing disparity between the... you know, the top and the bottom teams in the ABA. Irving in the final game, he had 21 points, 6 rebounds, and 5 assists. And then they won the final game 108-96. They swept the Colonels, who were a 55 win team in the East Finals, a much bigger surprise. Famously, in Game 3 of the series, which was in Kentucky, Irving had a fadeaway jumper from the free throw line over several defenders with just 1 second left to bank the shot in, and then gave the Nets an 89-87 victory, 3-0 lead. They would have won Game 4. And Adolph Rupp, the Kentucky coach we mentioned earlier, he said that Jerry West, up until now, he thought that Jerry West was the greatest basketball player I ever saw, with Oscar Robertson right behind him. But now he says that Julius Irving is the best. So, of course, high praise from Rupp. And then they make the ABA Finals, and they beat the Utah Stars, who had won the championship in 71. Still had a lot of that team together. Willie Wise, Ron Boom, Zemo Beatty, who was getting older at this point and had been hurt, and also had a shooter Jimmy Jones in this time. Boone and Jones were one of the best backcourts in either league, and, you know, the Stars were a 51 win team, so they were you know, they had upset the Pacers during the playoffs, but they certainly were a very good team, aging a bit, but still a stout team. But the Nets were able to beat them 4-1 in the series.
Yeah, and I almost have to feel bad when I think about these particular series. I almost have to feel bad about their opponents, because the Squires would lose in their last year to a guy they just had, and during a season in which they lost George Gervin and Sven Nader as well due to money problems. So they basically didn't have a chance to prove that they could compete. And the Kentucky Colonels must have felt miserable at the time, because they're this team that kept losing in these important moments, and they would obviously win it all finally the next year. But to lose in a sweep against Julius, and for him to make that incredible shot, I understand how Babe McCarty was feeling, because there's this quote that he was just sitting on a bench holding his head and was wondering, what did I do wrong? How can you beat that?
Yeah, and he lost his job, unfortunately, in his only season coaching the Colonels. And another thing that the Mike Gale and Wendell Ladner for John Roach trade between the Nets and the Colonels, that really did improve the Nets to, you know, a point where they, you know, it wasn't necessarily the one big difference in the series, but it definitely, I think, benefited the Nets. And you know, the fact that they swept them in this series, that may have added a an extra bit of contention between the two teams, an extra little bit, made it even a little more sour for the Colonels.
Yeah, and all in all, it might be the second most devastating playoff run in the ABA history. I think was it the Utah Star? Someone swept through the playoffs with two losses as well. But yeah, all in all, a very spectacular season for the Nets.
Yeah, and then they, Irving in game one, he scored 47 points. Keenan had 18 points and 20 rebounds. Actually, Jimmy Jones he made six shots in a row late in the game, but then the Nets, Irving switched on him defensively and was able to shut him down for the game one victory. Game two was known for, best known for a fight. About a minute into the game, Ron Boone decked Brian Taylor, and then he got up off the ground and punched him in the face. And apparently neither was ejected or even receive a technical foul. And
Yes.
So, the Nets won big this game, 118-94, and Irving had 32 points, 9 rebounds. And then game three, Zelmo Beatty, he missed the first two games. He played well with 22 points and 16 rebounds. And Utah actually had a 15-point fourth quarter lead, but the Nets came back and forced overtime on a buzzer-beating three-pointer from Taylor. And Irving, he had 24 points, 13 rebounds, 7 assists. He also had 6 turnovers and did not shoot well from the field or from the free throw line. However, the Nets were able to pull it out with a win, but a competitive game between both teams with a lot of good stat lines. Game four, the Stars were able to win. Jimmy Jones had 24 points and Boone had 22 points and 10 rebounds. Irving had a little bit of a down game for him, 18 points, 9 rebounds, 7 assists. Still, not a great scoring effort, but certainly, that's a pretty well-rounded box score there. And the traveling secretary, the trainer for the Nets, said that we thought we were going to win it all in Utah, so I had to buy all the champagne. But then when they lost the game, he said he had to pack it all up and bring it back to Nassau Coliseum. And it did. It was able to be opened after game five. The Nets won 111-100. Keenan had 23 points and 11 rebounds. Irving had 20 points and 16 rebounds. And he said that he felt that his individual performance in game five wasn't complete, but what we won, and that's what's important. He said he has lots of room for improvement. The main thing I want to do is maintain consistency. That's what I'm striving for. I don't think I'll ever run any faster, jump any higher, or shoot any better. I don't think my defense needs much improvement. I think I can block shots as well as anyone in the league, but it's maintaining consistency under pressure that is most important to me. So even, in the time of the greatest glory of his career at that point, was still talking about the things that he could improve on.
Yeah, that's what really struck me about Julius as being something interesting. When you look back at the interviews he gave during that time, he was quite well spoken and knew what he had to do and knew what he obviously had to say to sound like a thoughtful man. And obviously, he seemed like someone who was thoughtful. And you had the sense that he really was the best superstar he can be, in a sense that he knew how to talk with the media and he knew what he had to say.
Yeah, and Lockery
and obviously he had to do, because I can't act like he didn't execute on those things later on.
Absolutely, yeah. And Lockery talked about how he was very good at like building up his teammates and genuinely, saying nice things about praising them in the media, but also in ways that that he meant and were, not just for show, not like praising him in a fake way, but actually doing it in a genuine way and showing that he cared about his teammates. That was, that and his work ethic were, stood out for as far as being a superstar, in addition to, as you mentioned earlier, just, accepting being yelled at so that the other players had to accept it as well.
And also, Rod Fern was recently on Waj's podcast, and I think he told the same story in the book as well. You really have to love the stories of him improving on confidence of teammates. Like the story Thorne likes to tell about Keenan being down and having a bad string of games, and Julius just knowing that he has to make the extra pass for Keenan to have a great game, and that later on that Larry Keenan would score in the 20s and be happy in the game after the game in the locker room. So yeah, he really knew how to use these situations to improve chemistry and improve the morale of certain teammates.
And Irving, in his book, he talked about how after the series, he put his head down and reflected, remembered his brother who had died when he was in college, and also the coaches and mentors in his past, his late father as well, who he didn't know very well, and he said he didn't cry, but that he it took a solemn moment to remember those things, and then exulted in victory. And even though his coach, his high school coach, had told him never to brag, never to to always stay humble, he said that he allowed himself a bit of bragging during this time to praise his team and his performance. And he averaged 28.2 points per game, 11.4 rebounds, 5 assists, 1.8 steals, 1.4 rebounds, earning the playoff MVP award. So a great stat line, as we're getting used to throughout his early part of his career. And this is about a time in which his celebrity is really starting to increase. He manages a number of big endorsements, shoes, Dr. Pepper, other things, despite the ABA's lack of profile. And, really, in some respects, the ABA, if it had been able to start, let's say, around this time, 74, 75, and had, lasted around the same amount of time into the early 80s, you would think that perhaps with the cable landscape starting to spread in the early 80s, that actually the ABA might have had a different outcome in terms of having success, because the NBA didn't really establish a foothold until the mid 80s. So the ABA may have been able to, especially now, of course, Irving's timeline is different. He would not have been able to, he would have certainly joined the NBA earlier and wouldn't have been able to be the transcendent star that, in a mythical, 10 years later ABA. But if it had just been able to happen a few years later, I do think that outcome would have been different, because there would have been a there was really no place for the ABA to, if a national television contract wasn't going to be able to happen, there was no second place that he could have gone. But by the time the 80s rolled around, there would have been cable, and certainly now, if something like the ABA existed, with all the different social media profiles and, all the different channels that there are, Irving would be a national star that everyone would know, even if he didn't necessarily have the NBA platform to be on, just because, it would have been found out somehow. But it is interesting to just think it just a few more years later would definitely have made a difference in this case.
Yeah, it's also something I oddly enough, I have wondered about while I did the preparation for this podcast, because really, if you take the ABA and put them 10 years in the future, I think that would have been the perfect time for them to start their venture. If it had occurred between the 77 and the 86, they might have even got past the NBA. And of course, it depends on the types of players they would have got. And if we imagine a scenario where they snag one of Bird or Magic, or God forbid if they had taken Michael Jordan, I think they really might have gone past the NBA, because as it's told in various ways in the book, they knew more about, or at least they tried more when it came to marketing and when it came to socializing with fans. So someone like Dr. J would have really thrived in the early 80s with the advent of ESPN and cable TV.
Yes. And he talks at this point, he and his wife and kids moved to Gatsby country in, upper crust neighborhoods in Long Island, living among the rich. They refer to themselves as the Black Kennedys. He's also developing friendships with people like Bill Cosby, Arthur Ashe, Teddy Pendergrass, Miles Davis. So he's starting to live among the rich and sort of taste that life while he's still sort of trying to maintain, his humility. And later on, he talks about how one challenge in his life is he grew up with very little, and his kids grew up with a lot of money, and to try to give his kids things without giving them a sense of that they need to earn things and all that sort of thing. But it's interesting how during this time, you know, he even though it doesn't really benefit the league or the team that much, and it's not really drawing that well in New York, he is his own celebrity is increasing, and it's getting to a point where, you know, he's the the NBA has to pay attention to how, you know, how much he matters now to basketball because of these things. And Lockery was surprised that even with Irving being a hometown star and being so transcendent, that the Nets were unable to make any kind of dent in attendance or media. And Jim O'Brien, the writer in the 70s, who wrote a lot about the ABA, you know, talked about how I believe he worked for the New York Post, and talked about how, you know, everyone else about at the Post was sort of dismissive about, yeah, it's just the ABA. It's not, the Knicks had such a foothold in the in that town that the Nets got very little coverage, despite the, you know, the Nets clearly being, you know, even having won an exhibition game that season, and you know, being a more dynamic team at that point. But for, you know, just the inability to be able to kind of, you know, penetrate that wall was, you know, frustrating kind of for everybody.
Yeah, and obviously I'm not from New York, but it sort of reminds me of the same happening to New Jersey. And then we'll see how this Brooklyn Nets thing goes. But for some reason or another, then the Knicks just have this central place in New York in regards to professional basketball, and no matter what's the type of success and on the other professional team in the city, they just can't seem to get past the fact that the Knicks are the number one team in New York.
Yeah. So moving on to the 75 season, they're actually a stronger regular season team. They're 58 wins and a 6.58 SRS. Dave DeBuscher comes in as the general manager from the Knicks after he retired. And the Nets were four games ahead of the Colonels with seven games left to play, but they end up catching them with identical regular season record. And then the Colonels win a one-game playoff in Kentucky to beat the Nets. Irving talks about how his knee and groin injuries sort of start to affect him during this time and slow him down a little bit. Also later on, Lockery would say, you know, we relied a little bit too much on him, and, you know, he burned him out during the stretch. He has a game during the season where in four overtimes he scores 63 points, which I believe is his career high in the and maybe the ABA's high, but certainly
I do believe it's the ABA high as well. Yeah.
Yes, and you know, one of the transcendent performances against the San Diego Conquistadors. But they lose in the playoffs in one of the, well, probably honestly the greatest upset in professional basketball playoff history. The Spirits of St. Louis, 32 wins and negative 4.02 SRS, beat the Nets. The Spirits, famously Marvin Barnes, Maurice Lucas, and Gus Gerard, who are all rookies, also with Freddie Lewis, who was the Pacers' great point guard, who led them to a lot of finals appearances. The Spirits end up with a tremendous upset on great play from Marvin Barnes, tough defense from Don Adams, who's a journeyman forward brought in. After he'd been waived by the Pistons, made a tough physical defense on Irving, and really just a inexplicable upset. You know, other than just the Spirits finally sort of their youth coming together and having a steady hand from Freddie Lewis, there isn't really an inexplicable reason for the way the series went out. But the Spirits were able to win it in five games. The Nets actually won game one, and the Spirits won the rest of the games reasonably handily. Game five was a tight win. Lewis actually hit a 20-foot game winner at the buzzer to win game five. But other than that, there wasn't really a, you know, there was nothing about the series that particularly felt like a fluke, even though it's, you know, one of the ultimate shocks in basketball history.
Yeah, when I think of that season and that particular playoff series, I think of Marvin Barnes showing his real potential. The fact that he could outplay Irving, reportedly he was just better on the court, even if Irving was slowed down by injuries. It just says that he had real talent, and it shows how sudden his downfall was, because he went from outplaying probably the best player in the ABA in the series and willing his team to a series victory, to being a nobody like 3-4 years after in the NBA. So I think it's all about Marvin here.
Yeah, for sure. He was, as we've talked about in other episodes, it's just, probably the the ultimate case of having just tremendous potential and wasting it through, you know, all of the excesses of the 70s, whether it's, you know, the idea of, you know, players getting too money, a lot of money very early on in their career, or drug issues, or, you know, whatever kind of 70s excess you can think of. Marvin Barnes pretty much typified it.
Yeah, and that's not to downplay Freddie Lewis or Steve Snapper Jones. They obviously had a lot to do with it, because the team had talent that a 50-win team should have, and they underperformed just because of the personalities and their youth. So the veterans held the team together and allowed them to play up to their potential for one series. And I also remember there was this one center who came in later in the season. I'm blanking on his name, who decked one of the ABA top guys and earned respect on the team. So
yeah, that was Don Adams. Yes.
Oh yeah, Don Adams. So yeah, the veterans had a lot to do with it. But at the end of the day, Marvin was the one who was the best player on the team and who had to go out and play up to his potential. And yeah, for a period there, he did, as did the Spirits. And ultimately, Freddie Lewis's injury was the one that kept them from possibly making it even further to the finals.
Right. This is the second time in which the Nets losing in this playoff series prevented a opportunity for the Julius Erving George McGinnis finals that we, you know, we had discussed as a theoretical possibility before. The second opportunity for the Erving to play the Pacers, that version of the Pacers was, you know, without most, a lot of their legendary players had moved on, but still would the McGinnis Irving series obviously would have been tantalizing. So 76 season, the Nets are 55-29. They're down quite a bit in SRS, 2.56. Now they're, of course, Irving is there, Super John is still there, Brian Taylor is there still, Melchione's in his final season, and they've added Al Skinner and Tim Bassett, and then two trades between the Nets and the Spurs in the offseason in 75 are very important. They trade Larry Keenan and Mike Gale for Sven Nader, and then they trade Billy Paltz, and they get Rich Jones, Kim Hughes, and two other players. The Spurs definitely got the better of the trades in the long term, although Jones was very important to the Nets winning the title. Nader got hurt that year and was traded to Virginia for Jim Eakins, who was also helpful in 76. So that really helped the Spurs, you know, form the basis of their very good teams in the late 80s and, excuse me, the late 70s and a little bit into the 80s. But I doubt the Nets entirely regret the trade, because obviously they won a championship. And, you know, you know, losing Irving after the season, you know, even if they had other players, losing Irving was going to make them not a very good team. So either way, they're going to be in a similar position.
And, you know, James Silas missed the playoffs in his prime as well. So his battles with injuries probably prevented the George Gervin Spurs, meanwhile, from ever winning a title. And so at least the Nets have these two titles to their name. But I don't know, Silas was in his prime, and this would have been a year as good as any for the Spurs to achieve at least one opportunity to win it all. And that seven-game series, and I'm sure we'll touch on it just in a second, that seven series might have gone the other way if Silas was there. So at least they got the best out of the Julius experience while he was there.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and Jones and Eakins kind of made the more rugged team. They also preserved Irving down the stretch, even rested him some in fourth quarters, which he was very much against, but Lockery insisted, and he eventually agreed. As you mentioned, they played the Spurs in the semifinals. The Spurs have, you know, Gervin, Keenan, Paltz, and Gale all had played with Irving, and Silas was their other main player, but he was limited to one game because of injury. Game one, Irving Irving scores 31 points and has 8 rebounds. So the Nets win 116-101 pretty easily. Gervin had 20 points in that game. And Silas suffers a right ankle injury that ends his season. Game two, the Spurs win in a blowout in New York, 105-79. Keenan has 30 points and 10 rebounds. Gervin has 22 and 13. Irving had 27 points and 7 rebounds. and talked about how the team felt flat and really just were, you know, upset that they didn't play with more intensity. Game three, the Spurs won, although Irving had 31 points during that time, 10 rebounds, 8 assists as well. Keenan, again, had a great game, 28 points and 16 rebounds. He really had a very strong a strong series here. And Gale had a career high 22 points and 11 assists and felt very satisfied for you know, being able to beat his old team. That was definitely motivation here for the players to you know, play against their old, you know, whether it was the organizations or the old teammates, but it very much was a part of this series for sure.
Yeah, and at this point, it's almost confusing with the way that there are only seven teams who finish this season, and they trade with another just like every summer. So the supporting casts are almost tough to grasp with Julius playing with Jimmy Eakins the second time, but then you realize that Jimmy Eakins was his teammate in Virginia, so it's not totally the same. So yeah, I might imagine that when you face these guys so many times during the year, because obviously there aren't as many teams to have on your schedule during the 82 or 84 games, and then you go through a playoff series, it must get personal at some point, and you really get your competitive juices flowing when you're playing with these guys over and over and over again.
Absolutely. So game four, Irving has 35 points and 14 rebounds, and they even the series with a 110-108 win. He had the game-winning dunk among his 11 fourth-quarter points, and Williamson had 31 points, including 20 in the second half. And during this game, there is a pretty famous fight, and it's between Brian Taylor and George Karl, of course, the future NBA coach who was a Spur at the time, and both benches cleared. Ended up, Dave DeBuscher, who was now the commissioner, fined 14 players, and apparently Irving and Keenan were not fined. But Taylor, Carl, Jones, Williamson, Gervin, and Paltz all were fined during the game. I believe Loose Balls indicates that Irving did get into part of the fight, although he doesn't mention it in his book, so it's hard to say, of course, exactly what happened. I don't think there's any video of the game, but yes, that was the most intense that this game went. But I think it was a bench clearing brawl that took several minutes to restore. So even by ABA fight standards, it was pretty intense.
And in a way, it's almost surprising that the Boucher is laying the hammer down and finding all these players. It's almost unbelievable for that time, point in time. So it must have been a huge brawl if he had fined so many players.
Yes, exactly. Game five, the Nets win again, 110 to 108. I guess they had back-to-back games of 110 to 108. I just noticed that. And yeah, a lot of
in 2 days as well.
Yes, a lot of close margins in this. And and Irving had 32 points, 10 rebounds, 6 assists. Gale had 20 points in the series. He had a very good series as well. His scoring high and what would have been obviously close to a scoring high. And Irving actually was able to block Gale's shot away to seal the game. And he said, "I don't know how high I got, but it was high enough. I hit the ball with a full hand, just smash it back to the floor. It felt good." And Gale said, "I thought I had it. It looked good all the way. It seemed like it had eyes. And then he came out of nowhere." So just another amazing play by Irving to help seal things up. Game six, the Spurs won 106-105 despite Irving having 41 points and 12 rebounds, including 31 second half points. However, he did miss two free throws with about 2 minutes left in the fourth quarter. He did have a jumper that put them up 103-102, but Gervin had 37 points, and Gale and Paltz and Keenan all scored 19 points or more, and Keenan had two game-winning free throws with 3 seconds left to play in the game. And this is sort of an interesting situation with Rich Jones, where he did not dress for the game and show up for the arena. Lockery said he did not play due to mental distress, and there were rumors that authorities were after him in connection with unspecified financial problems back to when Jones played for the Spurs. So apparently they decided that it would be best if he laid low during the game, which very much an ABA thing to happen, that he would be missing due to these circumstances.
Yeah, and when I read over that, it seemed even a bit grim, even for ABA standards, for him to miss an important playoff game just due to that. And thankfully, as we know, he ended up being the winner in this transaction. But yeah, that was, I had forgotten about that detail, and it was weird to read about that.
And then Game 7, Jones comes back, and the Nets in New York, the Nets win 121-114. Gervin has 31 points. Irving has 28 points, 18 rebounds, and 8 assists. And Taylor helped Kia a big stretch with 9 points in less than 3 minutes. And the Nets are able to make it again to the ABA Finals by through this victory. They actually draw well for practically the first time, even though they're in, you know, the New York area. They're rarely drawing good crowds, but they had a standing room only crowd, and another 1,000 people were turned away, so they even struggled to attract fans even after winning in 74. So the fact that they were able to do that was a little bit too little too late, unfortunately for them, but a sign of the potential nonetheless.
Yeah, and then it seems like the matchup between Irving and Gervin was the one which decided the series, with Irving averaging 5 more points per game. And I assume that when two such even teams match up against each other, it's the superstars who have to take charge and be the best players in the series. And seemingly Irving was the one who did that, and which propelled New York to win in 7 games and land them a spot in the finals.
Yeah, and they landed a spot against the Denver Nuggets, who were 16-24 during the season with a 5.45 SRS, had been really the dominant team, honestly dominant regular season team for the last couple of years. They had fell short the year before, but made the finals this year. They had David Thompson, who was a rookie, and Dan Issel, who had come over from Kentucky and been a great star there. They also had Ralph Simpson, Bobby Jones, who of course would later be Dr. J's teammates on the Sixers, Chuck Williams, and Byron Beck, who was had played for the Denver franchise from its beginning in the first year of the ABA. So a good rebounder, defensive player as well.
The human eraser, Marvin Webster, also a magnificent ABA nickname.
That's right. Yes, the human eraser as well. Yes, he was a rookie during that season. He didn't have really a huge role on that team, although he did stand out at least in game one of the series. But yeah, the Nuggets were the favorites. But you know, as you talked about, kind of the situation where the superstars decided, and Irving just has a finals for the ages in this series, as we'll go through a little bit. But in fact, game one starts off with 45 points, 12 rebounds, and 4 assists, and hits a game-winning jumper from the baseline for a 120-118 win in Denver. He scored 18 of the Nets' final 22 points. Bobby Jones defending him throughout most of the game, and he said it's tough to defend him now, knowing he's always going to the hoop, but never knowing how. And Thompson had 30 points in the game, so played pretty well. And Marvin Webster, as we mentioned, had 14 points and 18 rebounds in that game.
Yeah, Bobby Jones, for as good as a defender he was, he must have been happy that for the longest period of his career he got to play alongside Julius, because he really had to face some high scoring games from Irving in this series as it went on. And I must imagine that it was frustrating for him for to go up against a player and just not be able to do anything about it, because throughout his career he mostly was a player who could stand his own against superstars and somewhat limit them in regards to their scoring.
And for game two, the Nuggets won 127-121, but Irving had 48 points, 14 rebounds, and 8 assists, In the fourth quarter, he had 25 points, which broke a pro basketball finals record by Joe Folks for points in one quarter. That is from the 22nd timeout website that you mentioned. David Friedman, the writer there, he unearthed that nugget, which was pretty cool. Unfortunately, the Nets did shot poorly other than Irving playing well. The Nuggets really had balanced scoring of 25 points from Ralph Simpson and 24 points each from Thompson, Jones, and Issel. Game three in New York, the Nets won. Irving had 31 points, 10 rebounds, and 4 block shots, and scored 8 points and blocked 2 shots in the final 2 minutes. And had a in the last 31 seconds of the game, he had a reverse layup, made 2 free throws, and had a coast-to-coast drive punctuated with a reverse dunk. So pretty much did everything during that game. Bobby Jones described that he came out of nowhere to get those late block shots. And New York Times writer Dave Anderson wrote that Dr. J was the best basketball player in captivity, perhaps in history. The NBA can't call itself the best basketball league until it features the best basketball player. The NBA without Dr. J is like boxing without Muhammad Ali, football without O.J. Simpson, and baseball without Tom Seaver. So obviously getting attention there. And speaking of getting attention, game four, Howard Cosell and ABC's Wild World of Sports would show up for game four as Irving would. He had 34 points, 15 rebounds, and 6 assists as the Nets took a 3-1 series lead. And had another tremendous game, and obviously the Nets are sitting pretty in this game with the 3-1 lead.
Yeah, and about the quote you mentioned previously, it comes as no surprise that the merger had happened this year because with the performances Julius is putting up in these playoffs, completely dominating, they just had to have a player like that in their own league, because as we all know, the NBA wasn't doing all that well in 1976 either. So yeah, the merger was really something that both leagues quite needed at this point, with the ABA struggling with their own finances.
And Denver won game five in Denver. They had a very, very balanced scoring, and they out-rebounded the Nets 51-2, 32. Irving did, again, 37 points, 15 rebounds, and 5 assists. But the other Nets don't really do much outside of Irving. Game 6, the Nuggets are in very strong position. They're up 80-58 midway through the third quarter. Looks like they're going to win in New York and send the game back to Denver for a Game 7. And Denver had just an incredible record in the previous two seasons at home. Game going back to Denver was bad news for the Nets, but the Nets turn it around. One of the great comebacks in basketball history, and you know, in hardly can think of a bigger situation than this. But Irving, he had 5 steals in the final 17 minutes. The Nets outscored the Nuggets 54-26. Also, Super John Williamson had 24 points in the second half. Irving, 31 points, 19 rebounds, 5 assists. And Denver had just 4 field goals in the final 12 minutes. And they decided to use a pressing defense, which sort of changes the tenor of the game. And you know, Lockhart talked about how, you know, they realized that they couldn't use it all the time, but they, you know, they brought it out just when they need it. And even though David Thompson had 42 points and Issel had 30 points and 20 rebounds, you know, it was obviously Irving's series. As Larry Brown, the Denver coach, said, "You can't tell me there's a more courageous club than the Nets. You can't tell me there's a greater player than Julius Irving." And just incredible performance from the Nets. And you know, Irving, one of the great finals of all time, one of only 2 players in pro basketball history to lead both teams in scoring, rebounding, assists, steals, and block shots in one playoff series. And the other, most people probably know, is LeBron James in the 2016 finals. So
yeah,
just a wonderful performance from him.
Yeah, it was just a complete breakdown by the Nuggets. And when you look at the stat lines of David Thompson and Dan Issel and the way they both shot the ball, David Thompson was 16-23, Issel was 14-25. It's almost unreal that they even lost this game. They certainly could have forced Game 7. And for the audience members out there interested in footage of any of this, I believe this is one of the best covered games we have of the ABA. I I'm certain that there was a made for TV documentary titled "The Last Day of the ABA" or something along those lines, which featured the storylines of Denver's coaches, of course Larry Brown and Doug Moe, as well as some stuff on Julius, and there's a lot of footage of this last game as well. So that's definitely something you can find on the internet. I'm not certain if it's on YouTube, as well as I can shamelessly plug that I have made highlights of Julius's and David Thompson's performances in this game, so you can also look that up. Lamar Matic, Lamar is in Lamar Odom, and Matic is in MATIC. But yeah, a quick search of Julius Erving 1976 or David Thompson 1976 should do the trick for these particular clips.
Yes. And I can say your YouTube has a lot of just wonderful classic NBA and ABA basketball from the 70s and 80s and beyond. So some really great stuff there. Anything else about Dr. J's time in the ABA that we should talk about before we go?
Well, the overall feel I get is that it's in a way the environment without any televised games, even for that time, it's not like that the footage is magically lost and the people back then were able to watch it. No, it's NBA executives and coaches. You get a feel that they also didn't really know what to expect from Julius, and it's created kind of this interesting environment in the late 70s, because when Erving struggled initially in some certain seasons, there was this barrage of articles describing the problems he was having, and that he's not really this superstar we expected him to be. So in a way, it sort of mirrors the situations which happen today with players just like LeBron, who have this big pressure put on them because of social media and the sports coverage which we have nowadays. And in a way, the opposite happened with Julius. There wasn't enough coverage of him, so he came into the NBA as this big unknown, and he got crushed probably more than he should have. And his latter part of the career thus had many interesting storylines, which might have been true or not, but in the end, I'm happy for him that he got the title in 83. So I think it's all worked out for the best.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have another episode coming with Curtis Harris, where we're going to talk about his time in the late 70s and early Phillies, or excuse me, his time in the late 70s and early 80s with the 76ers, and the expectations of him coming into the NBA and how he delivered on and how he changed during that time and how the league changed during that time. So hopefully people will enjoy that as well. But Reynis, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. And you have a great podcast on NBA history as well. Can you tell our listeners about it?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for the opportunity. The listeners can look up the Handle podcast. It's on iTunes and it's on Stitcher, as well as they can just log on lamarmatic.com to find the show notes for the podcast episodes, or just follow me on Twitter at Lamar Matic. And the channel you mentioned beforehand is probably which I consider my best work, because it's a medium where I have had more success in. So if as you already alluded to, if any of the audience is looking for some highlights from the 80s or 90s, you can definitely find me on there. So yeah, there it's not like I have some one specific thing to plug, but those are the many mediums where listeners can find me.
Well, thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at hardwoodparoxysm.com, and we are on iTunes and Stitcher, and wherever you listen to your podcast, it probably will be there. So just find us there. Give us a rating and review if you like what we're doing. And also, we're on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.